Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Venture with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I had Andrea Summer. Andrea is an entrepreneur, advisor, investor, and currently co-founder and CEO at Hive Founders. In today's episode, we talked about capital as an accelerant, not a requirement. We talked about defensible logic, and we talked about not being too trusting as a female founder when you have yourself surrounded by advisors. Let's get straight into this. Hello and welcome to this episode of Nothing Ventured with me, Arish Shah. Today in the studio with me, I am really excited to have with me Andrea Summers. Andrea is an entrepreneur, advisor, and investor who has built four businesses in the technology space, including in analytics and event management, femtech and wearables, as well as HR tech. She is currently co-founder and CEO at Hive Founders, a network for women entrepreneurs, providing education, investment readiness training, and advisory to a growing community of founders across the globe. She is also co-founder at Womankind Ventures, a dynamic and inclusive global angel investment group with a mission to get more funding to female founders. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me in the studio here today.
Thanks for having me.
So let's dive straight in. For our audience who don't necessarily know much about Andrea, I do urge you to go check out the primer episode where she gives us a bit of background about herself and what she's up to. But in the meantime, Hive Founders is a platform built by women entrepreneurs, for women entrepreneurs. What have you found to be some of the unique challenges for female founders and that they may encounter? And, you know, beyond purely the access to funding, which is something we'll definitely talk about, and how is Hive Founders actually helping to address some of those challenges?
Yeah, I think the main challenge that women entrepreneurs have is that the playbook of information, the vast playbook of information that's out there, just doesn't work for women. And we at Hive Founders have experienced that. We've all been through the process, the frustration of trying to do the things that are out there that we find on the internet that people, advisors tell us, trying and hitting our heads against a wall and failing, and then coming up with strategies that succeed. And that approach of coming up with a playbook that works specifically for women entrepreneurs is what we do at Hive Founders. So we use our learnings, our knowledge, and our expertise to help other founders navigate an environment and a pathway that's not really set up for them, using a playbook that we know works. Because it worked for us.
So I mean, you know, digging into that a little bit, like give me some examples of what didn't work that should have worked. So, you know, presumably when you're talking about a playbook that is out there, you know, things like Lean Startup, I guess, is one of the playbooks. And I've had female founders, you know, explicitly say to me, well, I followed everything it told me to do in that book and it hasn't worked. I'm like, Well, because it doesn't necessarily work for every business. You've got to think about it in the context of what you're doing. But what are some examples of specific advice that is, you know, almost taken as kind of, you know, unwritten law within startup world that hasn't or doesn't work for female founders?
There's sort of two ways that I like to think about it. On one way, capital and funding access is one part of the story, right? Women, because of the nature of women not being able to secure capital as early or as frequently as men, means that we need to build businesses that bootstrap for longer. Mm-hmm. The venture capital model is not designed for slow-growing businesses. It's designed for speed, right? So you're penalized for moving slowly, even though you have no other choice but to move slowly. The other area where women are really, really struggle and the playbook doesn't really work is in the composition of their teams, right? Is, you know, a lot of venture capital firms, and I think this is changing a little bit, have an expectation that, for example, you're not going to take a salary or you're going to be fully dedicated to that. That's just not realistic for women. Women have other commitments. And I'm not saying every woman is a mother or every woman is a caretaker, but generally speaking, women have other more well-rounded commitments that are balanced within their entrepreneurial lives. And the venture capital model isn't really accommodate that so well. So I think that there's like some structural issues that are really problematic.
Yeah, I find it really interesting. I mean, I founded my first kind of tech startup at the age of whatever, 43, 44, right? Mm-hmm. And similarly, like, you know, I'm at a place in my life where I have a family, I have two kids.
Yeah.
I'm not a 25-year-old, right, you know, with kind of unlimited ability to just kind of do what I want, take no salary, live on ramen. Like, that's not going to work.
Right.
And obviously, that's a choice that I've made. But structurally, you know, okay, fine. As a minority ethnic founder, it's potentially harder for me to find funding. Although, you know, I had certainly and continue to have great relationships. Mm-hmm. But for a lot of female founders, obviously, they don't necessarily have relationships already built up. They may be at that certain age. Yeah. They may have the family. They may not.
Yeah.
But balancing that can be quite problematic. The other thing that I get a sense of, again, speaking to a lot of female founders as I have over the last decade or so, is there is less chutzpah, right? And I don't mean that in a negative way. I mean, almost there's less arrogance, I would say, is actually probably the right way of putting it. A lot of kind of male founders will go out with a, you know, with a napkin, essentially, right? And go out and try and raise money. Whereas a lot of the female entrepreneurs I've worked with are really kind of focused on proving as much as possible before they go out. And in fact, I just had a conversation with someone recently. I'll give you an example. Obviously without disclosing too much, you know, they have a product that is already being sold. They're making some revenue. They are looking at targeting another market. This market is very design heavy. And the product that they have is not designed particularly well. And what this founder said to me is like, I want to build the product out so that it is like ideal for that design community and then go out and raise venture because then it's right. And I said, surely you should flip that, right? Raise a venture so that you can build that out faster, quicker, get to market quicker. Yeah. Is that the sort of thing that you're kind of alluding to? Or?
Yeah, I think women are not socialized to be comfortable with imperfection. We are socialized to be perfectionists. We're socialized to do it all, to have it all these things, you know, these myths that are unachievable for pretty much any woman. But it makes the entrepreneurship experience really uncomfortable, right? Mm. And I think also women are a bit too truthful in their presentation of things. And I'm not suggesting that people should lie, but I think people need to position things correctly. And also remember that, for example, when you're fundraising, you're selling the vision, right? You're not selling the reality of where you are today. You're selling the dream. And that's really hard sometimes when you don't have the proof points or you're not as far along as you think you have. You really compare yourself to a lot of things that are happening out there. And you think, oh, I've done nothing, even if you've done quite a lot for entrepreneurial standards. So I think that that's a challenge for women, one that we work really hard to help them overcome, because we understand that the process of fundraising is a game. And if you don't play the game correctly, you won't raise funding, right? So you have to learn how to play it.
I mean, I launched this podcast basically on that, like trying to level that playing field. And look, I mean, 100%, I've written extensively, or at least often, if not extensively, about the need for narrative over numbers, right? Totally. And like if you kind of abstract that away a little bit, essentially, as you said, it's the story that matters. The numbers are important.
Sure.
But directionally, you've got to be showing that you have, you know, you talked about it earlier, either the ambition or the kind of objective of reaching, you know, something scalable, especially if you're raising venture funding. Yeah. Angels may be a bit different. But
I like to think about it like a cake in a way, right? So you look at like the ingredients. Do you have the right ingredients, right, to build the kind of business that we're talking about, right? Mm. If you don't have the right ingredients, what can you do to fill those gaps, right? Then you look at it, the recipe, right? You learn the playbook. You learn what you need to do, the game. You figure out how to play the game. And then the frosting is your deck. It's your pitch deck, your materials, your narrative, right? Without a really good foundation, no amount of beautiful pitch deck is going to make you raise investment, right? So all three things need to kind of work in balance.
Yeah, I do a lot of this, but I've recently written a few times, you know, great decks get meetings, great founders get funded. And
totally.
And actually, if you think about that in more detail, it's, yes, great decks get meetings, great founders get a second meeting, but great businesses get funded, right?
Totally.
Like, and it's a combination of those factors.
Combination of the three.
So you've kind of talked a little bit about this, but you know, you founded Four Ventures yourself, and no doubt you have a bunch of war stories of your own. So what was the biggest lesson you learned? You know, how would you do things differently today, right? So the biggest lesson in your founding journey, and then kind of how you might change things.
I only get to pick one. I have so many.
I mean, choose three.
I mean, I think like the biggest lesson I learned is that you have to, I feel like the biggest lesson I learned is to not be so trusting. Mm-hmm. Even if people that you think you can rely on and trust, it's really important for you to actually know and not just be blindly faithful to advisors or investors or people who you think have more experience than you. It's important for you as a founder to do your diligence, understand the issues correctly, and make a decision on how to navigate things based on your knowledge and not based on other people's advice, right? Everyone has advice, everyone has opinions. You as the founder, you need to make sense of those opinions. And I think especially when I was a first-time founder, I was really trusting. I was not as confident, and so I relied on people who had done it before to tell me what to do, and I actually got burned several times because of that. So I think that's the biggest lesson. I think the second lesson that I would say is hire and fire people more quickly. So there's like, especially in the world of entrepreneurship, just waiting to try it out with different people, see if things improve, I think is just a waste of money and can really kill your business. So I think moving quickly with regards to people is also a really big lesson for me.
Yeah.
But it's both of them related to people, I guess.
Yeah. Well, and so, but startups are all about people, right? Like that's what it comes down to. You are selling to people. You are you are building it with people.
Totally.
It's interesting. Like the advisor point, I think, is really, you know, it hits home, I think, a lot for me because I'm often one of the guys giving advice, right? But what I tell founders is you should not take my advice as sacrosanct. It should be part of your arsenal of thinking, right? You need to go out, do your own thinking, figure out kind of what makes sense for you. Yes, take 2-3 opinions, but those opinions are just that. They're opinions.
Exactly.
We don't live your business, right? Yeah. We're not in it day to day. We're not going through the same struggle you are.
Yeah.
And it's important that, you know, I think great founders are the founders that have a growth mindset, are open to listening, but aren't necessarily, exactly as you said, you know, people who then just blindly follow that advice, right? They're able to synthesize and then make their own decisions. The second thing about hire, so again, I actually wrote hire slowly, fire, you know, hire slowly, fire fast, or whatever, however I phrased it.
I agree with that.
You know, and part of the reason is exactly that, right? You get burned because when you hire too quickly, you maybe, you know, you go with your gut, you don't necessarily sort of think about who is the right fit. Mm-hmm. But actually, more than that, I think the firing fast is really, really important.
Really important.
Like sticking with people who are toxic or the wrong fit or whatever, like that can kill a business, right?
Yeah, I totally agree. And I think back on the advisory point, one of the things that we really do and I am really passionate about is to teach founders how to think through and make decisions. How do you filter the counsel that you're getting and actually think through this thing? And I really like this concept of defensible logic, right?
Mm-hmm.
Can you prove and defend the logic that you're using to arrive at any particular part? And this could be your valuation. It could be your financial model. It could be your business model. It could be any aspect of your business. If you can defend your logic, it means that you've thought it through. And then it doesn't matter what any advisor is telling you because you understand how you've arrived at that conclusion, right? So I think it's all about filtering it correctly and defending it correctly.
Absolutely. And you know, if you have defensible logic, even if you're challenged, you can feed that logic back into your own kind of assumptions and reasoning and rationale, and you can decide
evolve
to change
it. Yeah.
And evolve
or
leave it to the side or think, okay, actually that might be relevant in a year's time when I've reached this milestone. That probably is something I need to start thinking about. But actually today, where I am right now, it's fine, right? And and actually, you know, so often, you know, I see, obviously working in the kind of finance side of things within startups, we see, you know, founders who come to us and say, we want to build out a financial model. Yeah, that's great. We have these 20 revenue streams. Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. How many of them are actually active right now? Well, one. I'm like, well, then show that one. Don't worry about the other 19, because quite frankly, like, they're not provable. Like, do it in a year's time. Do it in 2 years' time, right?
Yeah.
And
one of my pet peeves is kind of things that have not had any validation. It's like, I mean, it's better to have like a scrappy validation just to prove your point rather than build in a vacuum, right? Building in a vacuum. Don't do that.
Well, it comes down exactly to your point, right? There's no defensibility around those like 19 revenue streams because you're basically sitting there going, yeah, I think I can do this. Okay, fine. But you haven't, and you have no proof that you are.
Right.
So just leave it out, because the more you leave yourself open to being challenged, you know, it's very easy to get, especially if you're pitching an investor, it's very easy for an investor to get to a no. You want them to get to a yes.
Yeah.
The more you leave it open for them to kind of, you know, poke holes and find flaws, the easier it is for them to get to a no.
I think that's a super important point, because the thing, a lot of founders go into the investment process thinking that investors want to say yes, and investors don't want to say yes. Investors want to say no.
Yeah.
They just have so much volume, right? So they're looking for ways of discarding and filtering and going through and saying, no, this is not going to fit as quickly as possible, right? So if you're a smart founder and you're trying to navigate that process, you make sure you understand exactly what they're looking for, provide it exactly in the way that they are looking for it, so that you are minimizing the chances for them to say no, at least in the first instance, right? I mean, they may still say no down the road, but at least you kind of maximize your chances of getting to a second or third meeting.
Yeah, and I think what's really interesting, and this just keeps coming up in like every conversation I have, and maybe I have some sort of bias here at play, but I kind of sit here and I say, like, everything under the sun has been written. Like, there is nothing new that has been written about startups, about, you know, about raising investment, about, you know, there are a billion Twitter threads, or a billion, here's a list of investors, there's a billion, all of that stuff. But I sit on a bunch of kind of, you know, Slack groups and founder communities and so on. But it's the same questions that keep coming up time and time and time and time again. Mm-hmm. And I don't know if it's naivety, I don't know if it's lack of time or ability to you know, again, find those resources. But I keep coming back to this sort of question in my head is, like, there are so many of these communities. And again, we've interviewed, I think, probably in this season alone, I think three community founders of communities for female, both female investors as well as female founders. Yeah. And, you know, and of course, there are a plethora of other communities, mm-hmm. whether it's, you know, whether it's for minority ethnic, whether it's for just diverse, whether it's just founder communities, you know, on their own. But one of the things that I think constantly comes up in these groups is a lack of understanding of the investor mentality from the founder's perspective. Founders assume that, like, I saw one recently where it was like, yeah, we're, you know, we're trying to create FOMO, just like all the threads that we've read have told us to, and it doesn't seem to be working. And it's like, well, hold on a second. Like, you don't create FOMO. Like, yes, you can kind of attempt to create it, but the reality is FOMO happens when there's a hot deal that lots of investors are interested in. And it's not something that you can necessarily manipulate or hack, right? And I think there is this, there is also this kind of overriding urge on the part of founders that they are looking for that playbook that works, like, in 100% of scenarios, but they don't, right? As someone who has, you know, someone who has, I've personally raised money, I've also personally not been able to raise money, and therefore, you know, have not shuttered, but am now bootstrapping one of my businesses.
Yeah.
Like, things don't go to plan. And understanding investors' mentality is, like, a massive part of that. Like, again, we've had someone, I think, recently saying, you know, been raising for the last couple of months, but nothing seems to happen. It's like, well, hold on a second. Like, it takes 6 months to complete a fundraise.
Yeah.
And in Europe, you're sitting in, you know, whatever, June, July, August. Yeah. You're not going to get anything done anyway. So, I mean, you know, so switching tack for a second, like, members of Hive have actually raised close to $40 million. Mm-hmm. But the funding gap for female entrepreneurs has remained consistently and persistently hard to bridge, right? That 2% number has been perennial. Like, it's something that
it
comes up.
Me.
Yeah, it's just there. It doesn't seem to move. And we recently had Hussein Kanji from Hoxton. You know, he was very proud of the fact that Hoxton had invested in, I think 24% of its investments have been in female-founded or female-led firms. That's great. That's a hell of a lot higher than 2%, but it's not 50% at the same time, right? Yeah. And he certainly, I think, would admit to that as well.
Yeah.
But you co-founded Womankind Ventures to help start bridging that gap. So can you talk us through how it works, who participates in the syndicates, and how do you select the startups that you invest in?
So we invest in the businesses that we've trained. Essentially. Okay. So we get to know the businesses really well as part of our investment readiness program in particular. We understand, we open up the hood, we see, we get to know the business itself really well. We get to know the founder really well. And we were just a little bit tired of this process of training amazing founders and then going, fly birdies, go find funding. We didn't like that. We wanted to be able to be part of the solution and part of the momentum in creating their rounds and to putting their rounds together. And that's really what Womankind Ventures is all about. It's all about bringing this initial momentum for women who we believe in, the top performers of our programs. And that's essentially what we do.
So they go through the accelerator program at Hive and then become, do you invest in every single kind of company that comes through the accelerator? Or how does
No,
that work?
We don't invest in all of them. We have a scorecard process that we use to kind of assess founders. I have my own personal scorecard. Every investor has their own scorecard. We also have a group scorecard that enables us to assess whether that business moves into our pipeline. And then it's up to investors to decide whether they want to put money.
So it's kind of an at-will syndicate from that perspective. Yeah. And how many members, how many angels within the kind
We're
of
still
group?
Very much in the ongoing onboarding phase.
Got
so
it.
It's a pretty tiny group. We are just about to complete our first investment with Womankind Ventures. So yeah, we're very in the nascent phase.
Yeah, getting going. But I mean, look, there is nothing wrong with that. And I think, you know, again, it's a conversation that we've had on this podcast a huge number of times, right? You know, a lot of people would like to invest in startups. They don't think that they can. I know in the US there are, you know, complications around eligibility and so on and so forth. Yeah. But you can get going with like $1,000, right? You can make an invest, especially through a syndicate. Yeah. In fact, actually today, the syndicates are a great kind of places to do that. You know, I invested in a syndicate business through its own syndicate for like $1,000. You know, and that's, you know, that's the beauty of where we are today, right? Like, and obviously you then have companies like, you know, Republic and Crowdcube and Cedars and so on and so forth, which, you know, if you aren't directly involved in a specific syndicate, are really valuable. We actually recently had David Fogel, one of the co-founders of Alma Angels, on as well, which again, you know, invests very specifically in female founded businesses. And I think, you know, the more that kind of access to, So on the one hand, access to capital for the founders and obviously building that track record. Yes, we were able to secure investment from, you know, a group of people. I think on the investment side, educating investors as to those challenges that female founders also have and giving them access to deal flow that, you know, is has been vetted to some extent, that is, you know, that, you know, that has passed some kind of a bar. Obviously de-risks from their perspective, you know.
Yeah, I mean,
you know,
we're
where
not recommenders, right? We, you know, we're not, a financial recommenders,
Sure.
what I mean? But we work with businesses and we get to know the founders really well. We get to know their businesses really well. And then, you know, we have an opportunity to ourselves support them in a different way. And I think women in particular don't really see angel investment as an asset class that they're particularly comfortable with. You know, it's not something...
it's typically older male kind of...
And I think there's this perception that it requires very big amounts of money, right? And so a lot of women feel quite intimidated about the process. And so we focus on creating partnerships with other groups that can help educate investors on why there are benefits to this asset class, why it's a good cycle for women and a good approach for women to think about diversifying their portfolios, including angel. But again, we're not recommenders. We're not financial advisors. You know, like we can't guarantee, you know, that this is or that business is a good business. But what we do is we help connect women and inspire women to think about investing in different ways.
Yeah. So. And look, I mean, the reality is, in any case, like all, you know, every single startup comes with a disclaimer, like 90% of startups fail, your capital is at risk. Yeah. I think the reality is, though, I think a lot of people see the passion and the purpose in startups and often, like not necessarily always, but often businesses that are founded by female entrepreneurs will have a very, very specific kind of purposeful focus and objective, right? Because it's often backed by real kind of real life problems that they face. You know, again, you know, coming back to one of your examples, you know, an app that is able to track kind of roofie drugs and so on and so forth. Like, clearly that's come from someone that's looked at that and said, Jesus Christ, this is a really awful, you know, irreprehensible kind of situation to be in. And actually, like, as an angel investor, I'd be sat there going, actually, this is like, I get, like, not only do I get that this has value from a market perspective, but actually just from a societal good perspective, like, that's something that I would back, right? And I think you know, being able to kind of combine those two things is really important. And
I mean, I think a good investment opportunity, a good founder will be solving a real problem. A problem that you could be like, why didn't someone think about this before, right? And I think whether they're men or women, it doesn't matter, right? I think women tend to build things that affect them. Mm-hmm. Men tend to build things that affect them. And those things are different, right? Mm-hmm. We navigate world in one way. Men navigate world in a different way. Same, minorities navigate the world. So we all go through life with our own filters, right? And I think women build things that affect them, you know, and I think it's in particular femtech products I'm very excited about. I've built a femtech business myself, and I think that, you know, the medical space is hugely underserved for women, right? And so there's just massive opportunity, and it's like half the population, so you're really ignoring a huge amount of consumers by ignoring women as consumers, right? So
and ultimately women have, like, by share of kind of wallet, like, they actually command, like, I think it's 80%, like 80%, right?
So it's, you know, it's like it's just good business.
Yeah, exactly. Like, you don't want to write off 50% of the population.
Exactly.
I mean, like, you know, bringing all of that experience together from founding your own startups to supporting women entrepreneurs at Hive and Womankind, like in the current market, you know, which is a bit of a disaster, I think most people would readily admit. and it's probably going to decline over the next 6-12 months for sure. How would you advise any founder, but especially female entrepreneurs, to get started or kind of keep going even?
I think that economic downturns are actually a really great time to start a business because things that I think make businesses successful are scrappy mentalities, really being a good optimizer, right? Back to this initial point about, like, if you're a good optimizer, you can be a good founder. And the downturn situations require you, by their very nature, to be scrappy. So it's good business practice to learn that. I think the advice for women is the same advice that I give them, whether there's a market glut or a downturn. It's the same. Is build carefully, build in disciplined capacity, build things that people want to buy, and be scrappy, right? Don't be wasteful, be clear, be disciplined, and, you know, and then you're going to be setting yourself up for a good situation, right? For to maximize your chance. There's no guarantees, because there's no guarantees in entrepreneurship, but if you're scrappy and you're disciplined, you think, you talk to customers, you continuously create that cycle of customer feedback, then you're setting yourself up for success. And I also think that women tend to build businesses that are a bit more appropriate in bootstrapping ways. So we tend to rely on our internal engines of capital a little bit more, but just because we can't access external capital.
Yeah, there's almost that kind of thing in the hindbrain. Like, I'm not going to be able to raise money, so I've got to figure it out myself.
Yeah,
right?
And actually, I think that's really good. And I think investors are looking for that. Investors are looking for businesses that see capital as an accelerant rather than as a requirement, right? So if you build something, you get your minimum product, you get your validation, and you're actually creating some momentum, that's going to be much more appealing for an investor than if you're just building in a vacuum and just saying, well, I need $3 million in order to get this thing off the ground with no validation, right? So proving points and kind of moving yourself along the maturity line in terms of your validation is really helpful. And then goes back again to this point of defensible logic. Like, the more defensible your logic is, the easier of a time you're going to have.
Yeah, I mean, I think the capital is an accelerant, not a requirement, is a really interesting one, because it kind of goes both ways in the sense that I would fully agree with you. Like, if you're capital efficient, that shows that you are able to kind of manage your capital well and grow.
Yeah.
But, you know, there is a cohort of investors that will be, and I think these are the kind of older school type investors, where they'll be like, well, you haven't raised any money, therefore there must be something wrong.
Right.
Why have you only bootstrapped? Why have you only kind of, you know, managed the capital? And again, it's to that earlier point we discussed right at the top of the podcast. It is about making sure that you have the right narrative, right? And you can do, again, the defensible logic point, right? Like, this is why I bootstrapped from here to here, and this is why I'm now raising the money, you know, today. I couldn't agree with you more in terms of, you know, economic downturns are always, you know, where great businesses are built for exactly those reasons.
Yeah.
And I think this time round, we have, coupled with an economic downturn, we have this explosion of opportunity that's been unleashed with generative AI. There's obviously a lot of capital flowing into that space, but generally it's also lowered the barrier and the cost of building, because you can now, essentially, if you really wanted to, you could build an MVP, a technological MVP, using ChatGPT, right? Like, you could just get it to write the script that, you know, essentially builds your website, builds whatever the Python script that sits behind it, and you can come out with an MVP in a way that you couldn't have, like, 2 years ago, right? And I think, you know, the other thing that I think for me is critical is, like, for female entrepreneurs, for minority ethnics, for anyone, like, in startup world, failure is not failure. Failure is just a lesson learned, right? Like, I think this is the thing. You've been through 4 startups, you know, presumably, like, not all of them went successfully.
Nope.
So, you know, you've got to have, I guess, that modicum of resilience that allows you to keep going, to take those lessons and move forward, because, you know, otherwise, if anything was easy, then we'd all be doing it, I guess, is the point, right? Like, so you should not see failure as failure.
I mean, failure is the best lesson.
Yeah.
You learn 10 times more when things don't go right than when they do, right? So I don't even believe in the concept of failure anymore. Mm. I think maybe I never did, but I really believe that it's learning. And either it's a confirmatory or it's, okay, let's try something different. Let's explore, let's experiment, let's refine, let's optimize, right? It's going back to this optimization, constant successive optimizations, right? That's entrepreneurship. Yep. And no, there's no amount, you know, it will never end, right? This will be your life on a day-to-day basis as an entrepreneur. You're always going to be looking at the next problem and how you solve it. And that's what's great about it, right? That's what's fun.
Exactly. Yeah. And I think like on that very, very positive note, let's wrap the pod. But Andrea, thank you so much for coming into the studio and talking to me on this beautiful hot summer day in London. For our audience, where can they find you? You're online. Where's the best place? LinkedIn, Twitter. Where can they look for you online?
Best place to find me is on LinkedIn.
Okay. Yeah. And that's Andrea Summers.
Andrea Summers. Okay. Yeah. Or look for High Founders.
Amazing. Andrea, thank you so much for joining me. It's been a blast.
Thanks for having me.